This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 22nd of March, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, the US continues its bombing of Libya, but criticism of the operation is growing. In Yemen, more leaders join the opposition as President Ali Abdullah Saleh warns of civil war.
Everyone is essentially positioning for a piece of the post-Saleh pie.
And today is World Water Day. We'll take a look at opposition to dam construction on one of the world's longest rivers.
The Mekong River itself will have been drastically changed, and the fisheries will be lost.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Japan, where hundreds of thousands remain homeless and many more have limited electricity as rolling blackouts continue, four substantial aftershocks rattled survivors today. Electricity has been reconnected to all six units of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, but the lights aren't on yet. Officials will now try to fill the spent fuel pool in reactor number 2 with water to bring the temperature down and stop further radioactive emissions. Graham Andrew is with the International Atomic Energy Agency.
There continue to be some improvements at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, but the overall situation remains very serious. High levels of contamination have been measured in the locality of the plant. On the Fukushima site, the highest concern remains the spent fuel in the storage ponds of each reactor unit, particularly Unit 4.
In fact, radiation levels near the plant have been recorded at 1,600 times normal levels. Locals are being urged to stay away from tap water, and concerns are emerging about the possible contamination of marine fisheries. Two children are among four dead in Gaza as Israeli army attacks escalate and homemade rocket fire continues today. Rami Al-Maghari reports.
Medics in Gaza say most of those killed or injured by Israeli bombardments in the past 24 hours have been civilians, including several women and children. Monday night, Israeli warplanes launched a series of air strikes on southern, eastern and northern Gaza, injuring civilians and damaging a number of buildings, including a Hamas-owned medical clinic. Israel claims it targeted smuggling tunnels and suspected weapons stores. Adam Abu Salmiya is a spokesperson for the ambulance service in Gaza.
This morning, the Israeli army targeted a number of people in the eastern Gaza neighborhood of Shijaiya, hitting them with 5 tank shells.
The escalation began last week when two Hamas's operatives were killed by Israeli warplanes. The group's military wing retaliated over the weekend, firing a barrage of homemade rockets into nearby Israeli towns. French officials expressed concern about the uptick in violence today, calling for both sides to exercise restraint. Rami Al-Maghari, FS Oran, Gaza.
One of the Cuban Five says he's innocent and filed an appeal today. Lillian Bachter has more.
Gerardo Hernandez, one of the Cuban Five, has filed a significant legal brief in his habeas corpus appeal. This is his last chance for a new trial. Hernandez is serving life without parole for conspiracy to commit murder in the case of the 1996 shoot-down of the two brothers to the rescue planes. Hernandez says he was denied due process and was never told that he could testify on his own behalf if he separated his case from the others. In this appeal, he will be able to present evidence for the first time. Richard Klug, Hernandez's lawyer, says that the prosecution was based on suspicion and innuendo.
Now that Arada has the opportunity to speak in his own words, he's detailing how he's completely innocent, both factually and legally and in every possible sense. It's just a terrible injustice that he is being stigmatized as if he had participated in some kind of an attempt to kill.
Hernandez's appeal, as well as that of Antonio Guerrero, and the upcoming appeal of Ramon Labanino will also present evidence that the U.S. government paid journalists during the Cuban Five trial to manipulate public opinion. The U.S. government will respond to the new appeals on April 17th. Lillian Bachter, Free Speech Radio News.
The Supreme Court ruled today that employees can blow the whistle on illegal workplace conditions either orally or in writing. Kevin Kasten was fired from Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics after he verbally reported that workers were required to don and doff protective gear off the clock. losing as much as 2.5 hours' pay per week. St. Gobain said Kasten did not have legal protection under the Fair Labor Standards Act because he had not complained in writing. A Virginia man spent more than a quarter of a century locked up for a crime he did not commit. Now he's free. Brad Kuttner has details.
After 27 years, Thomas Hainsworth is free from a Virginia prison, his innocence backed by DNA evidence. In 1984, the African-American man was convicted of the rape and attempted rape of 3 white women. Hainsworth's case was re-examined as part of a sweeping review ordered in 2005 by former Governor Mark Warner. The genetic testing cleared Hainsworth and implicated convicted rapist Leon Davis. Hainsworth is happy to return home, but his case is not finished. He is out on parole for the time being, but still faces an appeals court hearing on March 30th. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
And women seeking to end a pregnancy in South Dakota will now wait longer than any other women in the country. Governor Dennis Dugard signed a law today that mandates women must wait 3 days after meeting with a doctor to have the procedure. They must also attend counseling at specific so-called pregnancy help centers. Such centers, by law, must give counseling that seeks to, quote, help women keep their relationship with their unborn children. Abortion rights groups say they plan to legally challenge the measure. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. The US and European allies are continuing their fourth day of bombing Libya. The US State Department describes the strikes as tactical operations against military targets in coastal areas and across the country. The State Department said the forces of Gaddafi, in defiance of the UN resolution, are engaging with rebels in actions in or near Benghazi, Zawiya, Ajibaya, and Misurata. During a briefing, US Navy Admiral Samuel Locklear described the situation in Misurata.
There are Gaddafi forces in Misurata. They are conducting attacks against civilians in Misurata, and in violation of the Security Council resolution construct, and we are considering all options. As we look across the entire country of Libya, the forces of Gaddafi were a fairly significant land force that he has arrayed in various locations around that country. We are dealing with it. The no-fly zone is in place. No-fly zone is effective. We have diminished his ability, I think, from an air defense and an Air Force perspective to the point where I'm comfortable with a no-fly zone. And then we're going to continue to pursue all actions necessary to make him comply with the Defense Security Council Resolution 1973.
Admiral Locklear did not confirm the number of those killed by airstrikes, but said the coalition aims to minimize civilian deaths. Some leaders of the African Union that initially supported the no-fly zone have expressed concern about foreign intervention and civilian casualties from airstrikes. The African Union has issued a declaration calling for the immediate cessation of all hostilities. And today, the Russian government called for all parties to stop the violence. Earlier today, 2 US pilots were recovered safely after ejecting from their F-15 warplane when it crashed during operations in eastern Libya. Admiral Locklear neither confirmed or denied a British report that during the recovery operation, one of the pilots opened fire and injured civilians. He said a full investigation was being conducted. Al Jazeera's James Bayes, reporting from the front line just outside the city of Ajibaya, said the rebels outnumber Gaddafi's forces but are outgunned and lack basic communication capacity.
One of the problems in this fluid situation is who, even the troops here, don't even know whether it's their own fire or the other side sometimes. And as soon as you hear a thud, everyone is working out, was that incoming, was it outgoing, who actually fired it before they move forward. It's a very, very confused and fluid situation. And I think one of the main problems for the opposition is they really don't have any communication or coordination of their forces.
In this eastern part of the country, on the border with Egypt, the United Nations Refugee Agency says it's dealing with a very challenging refugee problem. The agency says more than 300,000 people have fled the conflict and medical supplies and basic commodities are in short supply. Today in Yemen, President Ali Abdullah Saleh warned of the possibility of civil war. His government is facing a wave of resignations and defections to the opposition, from politicians to members of the army. The resignations follow a protest by many thousands of people on Friday in the capital Sana'a, during which snipers shot and killed about 50 people. For more, we go to Stacey Philbrick-Yadav, Assistant Professor of Political Science and a Specialist in Yemeni Society and Politics from Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you, Danny. Thanks for having me.
There have been new defections from the Yemeni government today, including, according to Reuters, the country's representative to the Arab League. How significant are these ongoing defections, some of whom, like the top general on Monday, have announced their support for the opposition?
I don't want to lump all of the defections into the same category, but I will say that the defection of Ali Mohsen, the general that you referred to, is broadly, I think, something that people are seeing through. He's not a credible opposition figure. And many of the people who are defecting are longstanding members of the regime who sense a sort of wind change, and everyone is essentially positioning for a piece of the post-Saleh pie.
So could this split in the army then lead to open armed conflict or even a civil war?
I'm concerned about that, certainly. And in fact, I read a report this morning about armed conflict in which two soldiers were killed by members of President Saleh's Republican Guard. So I think at a low level, those kinds of conflicts are already emerging. It's certainly a risk to have a divided military.
What exactly are the foundations of President Saleh's power?
Certainly, he has relied heavily on recruiting members of his tribal community, but I think that it's been an even narrower circle than that in some ways. And certainly we see that Ali Mohsen, the general who's defected, is from the same tribal confederation as President Saleh. So there's nothing inevitable about the tribal foundations of rule, and I think there's a risk of sort of overinflating that. This is a patron state. He's distributed patronage to people who've been politically loyal and punished people who've been politically disloyal, and he's been doing that for several decades. So I think the dynamic of patronage are at least as important as the dynamics of, say, kinship or tribal affiliation.
There have been tensions in tribal areas near the Saudi border for years. How are those tribal tensions playing into this?
Well, I think the tensions that you're referring to near the Saudi border actually relate more to the Houthi rebellion, this a sort of religio-political movement in the north it maps onto some tribal dimensions. But in truth, President Saleh has been fighting an armed insurgency led by the Houthis since 2004 and dealing with an increasingly militant secessionist movement in the south, in the southern part of the country since 2007. So essentially, he's beleaguered on both fronts. And the most interesting aspect of this is what it's done to the organized political opposition in Sana'a. The Joint Meeting Parties Coalition has really had to struggle to articulate itself as disconnected from both the northern and southern challenges to the regime, but at the same time, they have to cultivate the sympathies and loyalties of the population as a whole, and the sympathies and loyalties of the population as a whole have been shaped by the regime's use of force against people in the north and south.
You've written that the demands of the political opposition in Yemen align in some ways with those of the pro-democracy protesters elsewhere, but in many ways they diverge. What do you mean by that, and who exactly are the opposition in Yemen, specifically, I suppose, the thousands who are currently around the university campus in Sana'a?
So I think as the protests have been ongoing, there have been major shifts in who we speak of when we speak of the opposition. So when I wrote that, I was thinking primarily of the Joint Meeting Parties, which is an alliance of organized political parties that have been working together for nearly a decade now to challenge the regime through sort of legal institutional channels. They have increasingly over time become what I would say what I would call preoccupied with the court politics of Sana'a, with sort of engaging Saleh in the capital, and they've become really alienated from their grassroots. And we see that because when they agreed to enter negotiations with the Saleh regime, the student protesters just didn't stand for it. And the protests continued essentially without the leadership of the JMP. But at the same time, as I said before, the JMP has to be responsive to that potential constituency, so they have now finally joined with the student protesters and are really just simply demanding no negotiations, just demanding that Saleh leave.
Yemen is home to Islamic militant groups linked to al-Qaeda. How strong are those links, and what role are these groups playing in this uprising?
Well, I don't think that al-Qaeda is playing any sizable role in the protests. I think that's largely been a line that's been propagated by the regime. That said, al-Qaeda has thrived, I think, in the past 3 to 4 years on the instability that has been prevailing because of these engagements in the north and the south, and particularly in the south. And they have been increasingly popular as the regime has used more and more repressive force against civil dissent. So as people have sought political reform through protests and political parties and the kind of mechanisms of civil dissent, and they've been shut down and increasingly repressed violently, I think that as people have turned away from the regime, al-Qaeda, particularly outside of the urban centers, has been available.
Stacey Philbrick Yadav, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks again.
Today is World Water Day, established by the United Nations to raise awareness about the human right to clean water and proper sanitation. Scientists, environmentalists, and water experts have been gathering in Cape Town, South Africa, to develop solutions related to this year's theme, water and urbanisation. Dr. Hannah Louisa Bisiwi is Ghana's Deputy Minister for Water Resources. She says they face challenges in meeting Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs, but the government is investing in both water access and sanitation.
We are starting from next month. We will be drilling 4,000 boreholes in the first year. It's the effort that the government is making in trying to meet the MDGs and, in fact, go beyond the MDGs. Because as a country, we do believe that water is right. If water is the common human right, then any time we are not able to give water to a single person, we are abusing the right of that person.
The Millennium Development Goals include reducing by half the number of people without sustainable access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation. Some experts warn countries will need to invest up to $30 billion to meet these goals. World leaders say they're taking steps. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton joined World Bank President Robert Zoellick to sign an agreement to work together on water issues.
The approach proposed by the United States seeks synergies with water sanitation, irrigation, and resource management. It brings a wide range of expertise to the global table. The U.S. government is offering access to its experts in about 20 different departments and agencies. We're already working with some of them. For example, NASA is sharing its data and expertise with 5 countries in the Middle East to help them better manage their water resources. We're very excited about tapping NOAA's capabilities, and this MOU will make this kind of cooperation much easier.
Specific details on the agreement weren't publicized, and in the past, public advocates have criticized the World Bank for attempts to privatize water. Meanwhile, the U.S. faces its own water problems. Last year, Environmental Working Group released a study finding that a cancer-causing chemical, chromium-6, was widespread in U.S. drinking water. And fixing the U.S. water infrastructure could be pricey. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development estimates the U.S. would need to spend $20 billion a year for 2 decades to maintain water infrastructure at levels which meet health and environmental standards. In Southeast Asia, authorities along the Mekong River will soon decide on construction of the first of a series of new hydropower dams. Environmentalists fear the dams may cause lasting damage to the environment and the livelihoods of millions of people living along the Mekong. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
In northern Laos, the government is preparing to build a hydropower dam capable of generating nearly 1,300 megawatts of electricity on the main stream of the Lower Mekong River. The Siaberry Dam, the first to be built on the Lower Mekong River, is just one of 11 projects planned for the Mekong. It's being developed in cooperation with Thailand and will cost an estimated $3.5 billion. The dam needs approval by four governments, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia and Vietnam, which in 1995 agreed to ensure sustainable development along the Mekong system. The governments created the Mekong River Commission, which is supposed to involve local communities in the process. But Amy Trandum, an environmentalist with the US-based International Rivers, says the public consultations have not been transparent nor inclusive. Only Thailand allowed for community participation.
There's been no consultations in Laos, which is a huge problem. However, we've seen in Vietnam and in Cambodia, no community have been invited to join the consultations. And we feel that the Siaberry consultation process right now should be halted in order to allow that 10-year deferment so people can understand the Mekong River better.
The commission could announce a decision on the dam as early as this month. In official documents, the Lao government says it sees no reason for a delay. The government adds it has met all legal, environmental and social measures. But environmentalists say the Lower Mekong River dams would have a major impact on fish food stocks in areas such as Cambodia's Tonle Sap Lake. Vietnam also raised concerns over the Siaberry Dam. In local media, a deputy minister of resources and the environment warned the Lao Dam would greatly affect Vietnam's agriculture production and aquaculture. Climatologist Anon Srinivong at Thailand's Chulalongkorn University says while the dams will regulate water flows, they also harm biodiversity and the local economy.
It's very clear and very well proven. Fish in the Mekong, they are both food and also economies. I think one third of the economy of Cambodia at the moment rely on the exporting those fish to other countries, particularly Thailand.
Environmentalists say up to 40 million people would be affected by the dams. Some are also concerned the Siaberry Dam will be used as a model for future projects. International Rivers' Amy Trandum says the river's outlook is grim if the dams go ahead.
People will be poor because they have lost their main source of income, fisheries. People will not also have enough food to eat. And so this is a huge worry. And the Mekong River itself will have been drastically changed. And the fisheries will be lost. And important fisheries like the giant Mekong catfish and the Irrawaddy dolphin will be gone forever.
Mekong River Commission donor countries, including the United States, European Union and the Asian Development Bank, have called for more time to consider the Siaberry project. The donors want a deferral of 10 years to allow for more studies to fully assess the impact of the dams on the region's environment and its people. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
From Papua New Guinea to West Virginia, mining operations around the world have had lasting impacts on human health and the environment. But mining can also divide communities, as has happened in the small Chilean town of Caimanes. Here, 11 people recently began a hunger strike against a massive tailings dam filled with waste sludge from the region's copper mine. But in addition to fighting the pollution, these residents are also facing neighbours who say the mining company will save this small hamlet from poverty. From Caimanes, Jocelyn Wiener and Will Evans report.
Caimanes is a quiet rural town of about 1,200 people. But walk down the unpaved streets here and you quickly see something's wrong. Black flags fly over many houses. Signboards vilify the mining company Los Pelambres, which operates one of the biggest copper mines in the world, a couple hours away. The mine funnels its waste to a tailings dam wedged between the hills just above Caimanes. Residents like Esther Gonzalez, one of the 11 hunger strikers, say they're afraid the mining waste will poison their water or bury them alive in the next big earthquake. but it's the social impact of the dam that has already torn apart this small community.
The town used to be peaceful. The people were united. Now the people are divided, children fighting with their parents, siblings, everything. It's something that one can't bear anymore in Caimanes.
That's perhaps the only thing everyone here agrees on. The town is splintered into three angry factions. There's the group that supports the mine, the group that fought the mine for years before giving up, and the group protesting today. They tell radically different versions of the town drama. Some even accuse the hunger strikers of faking their 81-day fast. And everyone accuses everyone else of caring only about money. Margarita Olivares co-founded the group supporting the mine. She thought the tailings dam could help Caimanes escape rural poverty. The company brought jobs and gave grants to many residents to fix up their homes and start new businesses. Ahora usted ve que Caimanes,
pero sí. Now you see that in Caimanas, everyone has vehicles. Everyone has improved their quality of life, improved their houses.
Others in town accuse Olivares and her friends of being bought off by the mine. But Olivares turns the blame, pointing out that the protesters demanded new houses and more than $700,000 each. Negotiations with the mine broke down over the money. The company declined to be interviewed. Olivares says anti-mine activists have also threatened her and smashed the windshield of her truck. She actually has a lot in common with her old adversary, Magali Galarse. Galarse helped lead the fight against the mine for years, but Galarse too says she's received threats from the current batch of protesters and is nervous to leave home. Esta misma
gente. These same people who today are protesting that the dam is dangerous, that the dam has contaminated them, these same people, when we were fighting, when the dam still wasn't built yet, they never wanted to help us, never.
Back in 2006, Galarse's group won a crucial court ruling against the mine. But by the time the case got to Chile's Supreme Court in 2008, the tailings dam was almost complete, and the activists lost faith. They agreed to a settlement in which $5 million was to be doled out between them. Some were allotted much more than others, sparking resentment. The new group of protesters popped up, accused leaders like Galarse of selling out, and sued to prevent them from getting the money. Cristian Flores is the controversial young leader of the current protest movement. He riles up his followers with fiery speeches like this one.
We're going to fight until we are listened to, even if we have to end up some of us in jail or others dead, but we will not let a transnational company come humiliate us again.
Last November, Flores took his fight to the entrance of the mine, up in the gusty foothills of the Andes. The mine's trucks rolled in and out as about 75 protesters put up signs and pitched camp on the side of the road. Maria Raquel Soto took shelter under some rustling trees. She lamented that other people in town won't speak to her anymore.
Given that we all live in the same town, I don't understand it. If we all live there and we're doing this, we want something for all the people. Not like them. They benefited only themselves and gave the rest of the people nothing.
Early the next morning, the protesters gathered in the road, chanting and slowing down each truck before letting it pass. They shouted the Caimanes version of a popular protest chant. Caimanes, united, will never be defeated. It was a poignant choice of words. Because if one thing is certain in this entire saga, it's that in the face of a giant reservoir of mining waste, Caimanes is anything but united. Will Evans, Free Speech Radio News, Caimanes, Chile.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.